Accession number 28759, Real 5.
I don't think that they could have done anything without the 8th Army coming up. And relieving the pressure on them. The Germans have obviously got to move, hadn't they? I mean, strategically, they were going to get trapped if they stayed where they were. And so we eventually moved on and were able to, Fifth Army take over Naples and move on ahead. And the next strategic battle was going to be the River Volturno, which was the next defensive position, really.
How did you, you mentioned earlier when we were having coffee, how you provisioned yourselves, how you kept moving, how you fed yourselves. How did that work?
Well, it was, by organisation, and that was very good indeed, through divisions and corps, keeping ammo. Sometimes we used to have to send the ammo people back quite a long way to get, because as soon as you got ashore, as you could see, that was D-Day, and the Americans and the stuff they brought ashore was massive. And we have a completely different idea about that. One of the things that we did was a 25-pounder gun. It had, like all guns, has a rifling in the bore. 25-pounder, you've got the breech, and by taking the breech off, it was possible, you had artificers, you knocked out the lining, as we call it, rifle lining, because you cannot do predicted fire unless you've got a good lining in the barrel. So you knocked it out, sort of like replacing a piston. So you put new ones in, and then you can get it tested. You fired through copper screens, fired a shell through, and you took the time factor electrically. That gave you the muzzle velocity. And the muzzle velocity is important, because then, knowing the muzzle velocity, you can then do predicted fire. And so with the 25-pounder, we, all they did when they had 25-pounders, knocked out the lining, put a new one in, and you got it virtually a new gun with the right figure. We knew the figures because you tested it. Now, with a 105mm gun, it's got rifling in there, but when we were up and had a rest period, and we thought the muzzle velocity of our guns wanted checking, and so then we thought, well, we'll get the new liners. We hadn't seen any information about it. And so back in Naples, by this time, tons of equipment had been brought in. We'd moved off the sort of Salerno area. It was a vast stores area for equipment, masses of stuff. And so we sent the second in command down to procure some of these liners for our guns. Because we thought the next time we had a rest period, we'd knock them out and put new ones in. So we went down and applied for this indent through. It had to go through regiment, then corps, and so on and so forth. And then, because we were in Fifth Army, it was an American side, so we thought it was there. So we applied for these things, and this is quite true. Then we got a signal back, came eventually to the badge, said, "We don't understand your request for liners. We don't understand what liners are for your 105mm guns." So we sent a bloke down, and the signal command went down there. We saw a head man who was a one-star general, and we went down there and said, "Gee whiz," he said, "I don't know what you're talking about." So he said, "We want a liner for the guns, and we're going to reline the guns." He said, "What do you want to do that for?" So he said, "Well, because we, you know, want to do things." So we get the muzzle velocity up to scratch. He says, "Oh, well, gee, we know how to do that." So he said, "Come with me, my boy." I took him in his vehicle down some 4 miles away or something to some big depot, and he said, help yourself. And there were thousands of these things complete, guns, tracks, engines, there, even down to torches. So that's one lesson we learned that after that. They don't do that sort of thing.
So did you discard your guns and get new ones?
Yeah, we're getting brand new ones. We can re-track them, put new tracks on, said rubber tracks. But they don't bother with it. That's their attitude, and saying, well, they've got their stuff there. So that's one lesson we learned there.
Did you go into Naples yourself?
Oh, yes.
Tell me what that was like. Naples in 1944. Is it 44? No, I'm getting the date wrong. It's 43, isn't it?
July 44, D-Day. July 44 was with the ends.
No, this would be, this would be...
43.
It's probably September 43.
Yes. It was... it's a bit of a shambles. They'd had a bombing and so on and so forth, but it was quite a relaxing sort of place, really. We didn't spend very much time there because we were through and I was up the coast a bit on the Volturno. But it was a place where anything goes. You had to watch your kit, watch your cars. Never park your Jeep outside in the office, because when you came out, the tires and wheels are gone. They were the quickest people getting wheels off cars. Never put anything down.
And did you go out in the evenings there? Did you fraternise at all?
Yes, the club, various clubs opened and so on and so forth. Well, you were involved, you see, because it was still sort of up the road a bit. It was where the war was going on. It wasn't far enough back, really, to start with. And you didn't go down to Naples on leave. You arranged leave. We had a leave, actually, but the next place to Maiori, which was... we had a leave hotel there. And that was for the division. You could... book in there, and the chaps all went on leave there. And was that about it? No, it was a pretty sort of serious business. War. We didn't have. Italy was. I mean, we didn't. It was. The thing I noticed as soon as I went to Europe. We never looted anything in Italy. Not like they were in Europe.
I was going to ask you, was there any looting? Did you do any of your troops?
I never saw much of looting. We treated the Italians. They treated us well.
Apart from the
fact... We traded with food, you see, rations. They hadn't got any grub half the time. You know, there were fields were decimated places. I mean... We used to think nothing of it, and then you realise what a bloody mess you were making. I mean, when we got into where there were vines, vineyards and things like that, and you just run a few tanks through there, and you wreck the whole caboodle. And, but then, once you were through and were clearing up any mines that there might have been there, then you could utilise the land. Because we had to build depots everywhere, and my brother-in-law, after AMGOT, he was in the legal division of the army. There was a lot of that. You got, deserters and people like that, and courts martial back at base.
Did you have any problems? How did your troops put up with being under fire? Did you have any of those sort of problems yourself, people?
The artillery was. Luckier than the infantry. It never had the casualties that the infantry had. I mean, until we got to a place like Anzio, where everybody was under fire. And, the infantry blokes, you'd be liaison with a battalion or had mainly infantry, where you'd join them at night time. We had an OP in one or two places where at night we'd go across to the nearest infantry company who had outposts out, and be there in case he wanted some fire at night to attack. And then you'd realise, when you talked to the company commanders and the battalion commanders, that he'd replaced all his men already since the battle started, or since he got there.
Through casualties,
yeah. See, sometimes you had casualties, and other times they were sort of piecemeal ones. But very often a casualty, I mean, wasn't like the 1418 war, where, I mean, you just wrote off battalions, didn't you? I mean, that's because of the way they operated. But here, I mean, they did in landings and D-Day, there were quite heavy casualties on beaches. But various static positions, I mean, when you read the things now at Caen, it wasn't all beer and skittles at the first 3 months on D-Day. I mean, they had the most appalling casualties, whether it was some of their fault with tanks. Well, I mean, they wrote off about two or three squadrons of tanks. The attack on that coastal town, Caen, wasn't it?
Caen, yeah. They've just discovered a new battery. Did you hear that yesterday in the news that they no one knew about at the time? That continued firing, called the Maisie battery, I think.
Oh, yes.
Which
yes.
continued firing onto the beaches and killed hundreds and thousands of Americans, I think. But anyway, let's get on with our story, your story. The River Volturno is next, isn't
That's
it?
That's right. And then there was this Grigliano. There were two rivers that ran into the sea, but they were both river crossings, Volturno. And we had troops, we had some fortified areas where we had a gunner, OP usually, and a company of infantry occupied a semi-fortified area, and mainly for observation and while we decided what they were going to do, because obviously we were going to have a river crossing, usually finishes up in a brigade at least, perhaps even a division, organised battle. And so there was a battle plan, and you had you knew the people you were going to support and so on. And one or two, you used to have one or two hiccups there. On the, it was either the Grigliano, we were very keen, the army was very keen to get, use propaganda. Americans used to quite a lot of used to use loudspeakers. I don't know how effective it was. They used to point these loudspeakers towards them, and they'd say, "Do you want a cup of coffee?" I don't know whether they said it in German or English. It seems absolutely crackers to me. I should mention, I imagine to start with they said it in English, then suddenly the penny dropped and they said, "Well, perhaps not all of them spoke English." But this was the unit in Army or Corps headquarters which dreamed up all these things, propaganda. Because we were getting leaflets propaganda. Particularly at Anzio we got them, but even as early on as the Grigliano we used to get leaflets about the Americans, trying to split us from the Americans.
Dropped by the Germans?
Dropped by AIS leaflets, yeah. There used to be rude cartoons, it's possible, you know. Certainly at Anzio they had them. We used to pick them up as soon as they because if you got back to Naples on leave, you could flog these for about, you know, a couple of quid or four.
What did they have on them? Can you remember?
Well, because when we were at Anzio, which we haven't quite got to yet, but when we got to Anzio, the Germans used to say, "This is the biggest concentration camp in Italy." It's to us, you see. And while you British are in the concentration camps, the Americans are living with your wives. There used to be a rude picture of there, the Yank taking his clothes off or something, or anything like that was good for the...
And did any of these ever strike home, or did they just make you laugh?
Made us laugh. But the funniest thing I was involved in, I was asked to produce two guns. And because I was, at that time, I was CPO, command post officer, which meant you had to do make sure with the guns, survey them all in. And we were asked to produce two guns, and Army was producing a German paper, newspaper, called Front Post in German. And this was printed, and the advantage of the 105 is we could fire, or you can also with 25 pounders, but because of the ours were slightly bigger shells, you could use the smoke shells, which were normally unscrew the back of the shell, and you'd put smoke canisters in, you see, we wanted to produce smoke, and had a timing fuse on it, which blew the end out and dropped smoke, which is quite useful sometimes. And so they adapted this. We wanted to fire these newspapers. It was called, as I said, Front Post. It was rolled up. We tried them out on the ranges behind the lines once. We had a few problems with it. Either the paper caught so scarred, and it didn't do it right, or it didn't land in the right place. Well, eventually we got that right. And so on the river side, it was either there or the Grigliano, but we tried them on the Volturno. Used two guns. The difficulty was there was quite a long open space between our battery at the moment, which is behind, and the thing about these are howitzers, don't forget, and that you like to cock the gun up a bit because you don't want to use the maximum charge, because that is rather tricky with the paper inside it. And so it meant moving the guns up in the dark into a surveyed position back from where you wanted them to land, which was on our side of the river, and poop them off and then move back out of harm's way, because you were actually under machine gun fire, if you're close as that. And so we did those, and we surveyed this position in, and we were going to do all this. And we had a secured area of which a colleague of mine was one of the troop commanders. He was a captain, and he was in with the infantry in this, the company area, and normally in a fairly exposed position, but had dugouts and they're quite safe there. And we'd written the orders out, and we were going to let them know when we were going to fire and so on and so forth, because what we didn't want to do was to, what we were hoping for was that we were going to explode these shells in the air, and the paper rolled up, it's going to come out, flutter down, and land somewhere near the German lines, you see. And we hoped that they would read him, because it gave the news of what was happening in Russia and all the other things, food propaganda. And it was Henry was in this fortified area, and we did all this, surveyed him in, went up at night, because it made a bit of a noise, but got him in position, and pooped off rounds as quick as we could, and they worked quite well, and they did burst over the jerrys, and the paper came fluttering down. But unfortunately, the area around our fortified thing, farmhouse on this thing where the troops were and the observation were, they were by telephone, and that's what we have. We didn't want to use radio because we wanted to give the show away, and they got mortar, and the lines all went for Burton. And so when they dialed it down, they couldn't get hold of them. And of course, the things landed. And the Jays came down and they weren't being shot at, so they went out and collected these papers. And they were very short of toilet paper, so that was the one use that they were able to put it to. Anyway, they came running out, and of course, his lads up on the thing, they saw all these troops coming out, so they opened fire with machine guns, which wasn't the object. We were hoping they were going to collect the newspapers to see and read all this stuff. And so that was a bit of a failure, because I think the Germans said it was a dirty trick, you see. We sent over the newspapers, got them out of their foxholes, and fired at them. So that was a propaganda that didn't come off. But we didn't have any casualties, and it worked. But
what about the fire? It says here that the fire plans were fairly extensive fire plans were used to support the crossing of the Volturno in between the 12th and 13th.
Oh, yes, they were, that just took a lot of sweat and thing about getting the ammo up, and on fixed lines is all predicted fire. And you did fire continually, fired a lot to help them over the river. River crossings are very difficult. And everything seems to go wrong. The boats, the river's either too strong or it's very difficult. And you don't get your armour over there until you've built the bridge, and they're putting the bridge up, pontoons. There's poor old REs, they've sweated their guts out, digging some of the mines out on the approach road, and they put the tapes down and in the dark, and things go wrong very easily.
And how was that crossing?
Well, it was eventually down, I think, and I'll rather forget the Volturno one, but they got through it eventually. We fired a lot, and generally speaking, you got one battalion through, and you know, you had to try to keep the casualties down. It's very difficult sometimes. And some battalions are better at it than others. Very difficult being an infantry officer, I think. Inspiring the chaps to take off.
But, what about the second river then, the Grigliano?
Grigliano. Well, that was eventually, I don't know what it says in there, I forget what the sort of casualties were.
Garigliano. This is in the 1st of November, 1943.
We depended going inland a bit to see, and it was getting pretty mountainous. It's much more rugged than people think it, really. They think, you know, think of beaches and swimming, and but it's actually very hilly. The only people in their element seem to be the Goumier, the French mountain troops, and their donkeys or whatever they had, mules. They did it the trick. Well, I mean, we are getting to the near Casino now, and Caserta, which is the army headquarters. We used to have to go back there quite a bit, Caserta. I remember going back there, we used to go and, you said, didn't we fraternise? Didn't fraternise, but we used to have ENSA concerts, and they were usually back there, and we used to have to send armoured cars back, or White Scout cars, quite useful for that, to pick up a party, because most of the little Italian villages all had opera houses, or little theatres, so it was quite good for entertainment and stuff like that. Which you tried to produce now and again, relieve the boredom. And there was a lot of waiting about. We were very lucky. We never got involved in Casino because we were back at Christmas now in the end of 43. And then we started organising the Anzio sort of leapfrog thing.
Yeah, go. How did that take place?
Well, it was at the same time while we were getting on board the various ships, I went up on an LST, and we had one or two naval ships. It was two divisions, the first infantry division. His name Penny, I think, the general commander, and the American guy, and he's the one who, American chap, was the corps commander, he was commanding, had been at Salerno, and that was one of the reasons why we didn't get a move on, because we landed virtually, not a shot was fired. It was on a weekend, and it was a bit of Natuno and Anzio. It was a sort of holiday place, really, for the Germans, a leave place. There was no resistance at all. We got ashore, and we sat for a week and did nothing. And the Americans moved on the right, and they tried to get to a place called Cesana, but I don't know what happened. They had a Ranger battalion that got put in a bag. They got counterattacked. I was on the right-hand side. But we had one or two Americans in jeeps got into Rome. So drove up there into Rome. Came back again. Said, come, it's all clear, go ahead. We waited for a long time, and then we did this attack down the road to the Alban Hills. It was like a finger sticking out. We'd moved into some dunes on the left-hand side. We had the regiment there, fired a lot, supporting them. And we had a brigade going ahead in Anzio, and we got counterattacked literally at the sort of finger end. And they had to fight to get back to what they call the flyover, which was a very useful road over a road and a railway line. From Anzio, the railway line went, joined the main line into Rome. The object was to go and capture the railway line just on our side of the Alban Hills. And if we'd gone on the first week early and got all together to do it, we could have done it, I'm sure of that. But we got bogged down, and it was a failure. And we started getting a lot of casualties because the infantry had a lot of casualties. We had a, compared with anywhere else, I think, and back here. And then we'll see from the wounding I know on here.
We're at the end of 43, aren't we, here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is 44.
So it would be here.
It's January 44, we're at Anzio. And,
The whole pages of casualties.
Yeah, it's contained. These are the dying of wounds here. And you can read one, you read down ten here. There's only two for Syracuse, Catania, South Messina. And we're coming up to the Grigliano part. And there's Anzio here.
Page after page, yeah.
And these chaps here are the wounded.
Graham Rowntree, Reel 6.